Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Thank you so much for downloading. You can get more information on the podcast at dsmsports.net and see other great content. And of course, follow me on Twitter at njh287. Really cool episode for you guys today, especially if you're a fan of hockey, photography, just the way that visual media is really taking over the internet, taking over social media. Going to be talking to Bruce Bennett, really a legendary photographer, especially in the hockey world, director of hockey photography for Getty Images, and author of the new book, Hockey's Greatest Photos, The Bruce Bennett Collection. But before we get to our conversation with Bruce, all about how social media and digital media is changing the photography game in sports, we have this episode's helpful tool. And this episode's helpful tool is Google Forms. Anyone who works in marketing and sports marketing knows all about the importance of capturing data and getting people to sign up, whether it's for a ticket buy, group sale, kids club, booster club, flex pack, or even just taking polls and capturing data through Earn to Win contests. You always need a form. And oftentimes it's about finding a free form provider, an easy, simple form provider. Well, look no further than Google Forms. It's part of the overall Google Docs regime, umbrella, whatever you want to call it. And all you need is a Google account. So if you have Gmail, you're already good to go. Just Google Forms, or you can go to docs.google.com and go to create a new form, and then you can do whatever you want. You can even control the confirmation page. You can add as many fields as you want, make it multiple choice, make their required fields and optional fields, have people choose from a list. You can get their name, email, even credit card number. Really just everything you possibly want to do with a form, and then you can link to it, and then or also use an iframe to embed it on your website or in a mobile app. Just an incredibly easy way to create custom forms with an easy click of a button and start to collect some data, whether it's for, again, a club you want to start or even just a simple contest you want to run and not have to worry about the old-fashioned tools of paper and pencil. And if you don't have an easy form site that's already built into your media, Google Forms is your free answer. And you can even customize the confirmation page, and really just the sky's the limit. So start to build some forms, start to capture some fan data, and have some fun as well with your fans. You know, do some polls, do some surveys, do some trivia contests. The sky's the limit, and it's up to you to make the most of it. So check it out. Go to Google Forms, and I want to see you start creating some forms and embedding them and sharing them and engaging your fans with them and also becoming better sports marketers with them. All right, that's this episode's helpful tool. I look forward to filling out one of your forms soon, and we'll be right back to have a really good conversation. Stay tuned for our talk with Bruce Bennett, legendary hockey photographer, director of hockey photography for Getty Images, and of course, author of the new book, which we'll touch on a little bit, Hockey's Greatest Photos, The Bruce Bennett Collection, coming right up. All right, that was this episode's helpful tool, but we'll have more about that later. Now we have a great interview coming up for you. We're delighted to have one of the legends in hockey photography. He is the director of hockey photography for Getty Images, a longtime Getty photographer in hockey, and author of new book, Hockey's Greatest Photos, The Bruce Bennett Collection. We are delighted to have on the podcast Mr. Bruce Bennett. Thank you so much for coming on, Bruce.
It's great to be here with you.
Really, really cool to have you on as someone who's been in hockey myself for a while. You are a name that has come across the board several times, and whether fans know it or not, there is a good chance they have seen some of your work throughout the space at some point in time. But before we get into the meat of the interview today, I'd love to really hear about your career path, you know, how you got going into photography, into hockey in particular, any tips along the way for folks that would like to emulate you or just learn more about you.
Well, I'm not going to give out any tips on how everyone should become photographers because I really don't need any more competition at this point. But that being said, I started as a naive 18-year-old kid shooting pictures from the balcony at Madison Square Garden and at warm-ups at an Islander game, and sent those pictures up to the Hockey News, which was then being published in Montreal, and asked them if they wanted to buy photos. And 41 years later, here I am shooting hockey photos for a living.
So this was when teams did not really have a photographer themselves, let alone leagues or publications. And what was the main sort of entry into that kind of work?
Well, starting back then, the Hockey News had asked me whether I could get into games on my own or whether I needed a photo credential. And they were good enough to get me a photo credential. And all my work back then went to the Hockey News. So I would go home after games and make 8x10 prints or 5x7 prints and send them up to the Hockey News for use in their weekly publication. Team photographers were there for the teams and local newspaper guys. And back then, there were a lot of freelance photographers that would come in and out of arenas and, you know, sell pictures to anyone they could. These days, it's a little bit more difficult. You still have the team guys and the newspaper guys and the photo agency guys, but it's no longer permissible to go into pro venues, regardless of the sport, and go out there and freelance and try to sell images everywhere. That's just not permitted anymore.
And so it goes without saying, I guess, when you were first coming up, the technology was much different than it is today. Or were you lugging around a big camera and having to develop photos yourself? Were you stopping at a film development place to have someone develop those pictures for you?
You know, most of the time I would bring the canisters of film home, and either that night or the next morning I would process the material, make 8x10 prints or, as I said, 5x7 prints, and write on the back of each print who the players were, put them in envelopes, and mail them out to clients. In later years, went into shooting more color slides, and even those, after a few years of sending those out to be processed and getting them back in a day or two, ended up with large slide processing machines where that material would be processed, and guys who worked for me, full-time researchers, would label the side of the slide mounts with players' names, and then those would be put into envelopes and sent out to clients.
Wow.
But it always was a lot of photo equipment, and even today with the digital age, that equipment is no easier and no lighter to lug around.
Well, it probably goes without saying that these days your average AP Hockey News photographer probably can't develop their own film. I mean, that's probably something that most people can't do these days, and some skills that you had to pick up pretty early on, I guess.
Yeah, I think I had the benefit. One of the benefits I had over a lot of other photographers is that I was always a computer geek. From the time that computers were first available, starting with an Atari computer, and moving on to a PC, I think my advantage was I took to digital pretty easily and took to digital imaging easily just because it was something that that I was interested in. Other photographers, especially some of the older guys, as I've hired guys in other cities, it seems like the ones who can take to the digital imaging and are good at the captioning and the photoshopping are the ones who are a lot easier to hire, simply because, you know, you don't have to worry about holding their hand through all the digital manipulations of getting those images onto the Getty Images site.
Let's talk about that real briefly to pivot out of that, and that is, I guess, that the velocity and the speed at which you're providing images now is really exponentially faster than it was when you were, you know, developing film and sending it out via a snail mail, for lack of a better term. I mean, how does that really affect your job day to day when you're expected to deliver photos by intermission instead of by the next day?
Yeah, it's I mean, it's more comfortable for me now than it was when I first started. It's quite an intense process between periods to get out a bunch of images. In fact, when I first had to start going through this, when I joined Getty Images in 2004, I used to joke that I was going to sue somebody when I would get a bladder infection because I didn't have time to go to the bathroom between periods. But the process is really, a big part of the process is knowing your computer and having the fastest possible computer that you could that you can acquire. And there are a whole bunch of tricks to get those images out between periods. All these arenas now provide you with pretty fast Wi-Fi, so that helps on that end. Mm-hmm. But being able to ingest a digital card or two into your computer between periods, pick out the best images, Photoshop them, and then caption them, it's a lot of work, and it takes a lot of time. So it's imperative to get to your computer as quickly as you can between periods, and it helps. The more experience you have in that sort of thing, obviously the better you are at getting images out quickly.
And has there just been a complete change in your mindset for how you really go about doing your job now? I mean, when you were working with canisters of film, you had to make every photo count a little bit more than you do now, where you can snap, you know, thousands of pictures in one night and not have to worry about, you know, you going through loads and loads of film. I mean, how does that change the way that you kind of do your job every night?
Well, you're still looking, you know, for the peak action and the important photographs. I think the other factor that comes into play is, sure, you could lean on the motor and you could shoot, you know, 2,000 frames during a game, but the problem is, between periods and then at the end of the game, you need to go through all those images.
Mm-hmm.
So if you overshoot, then you get bogged down when it comes to the editing phase, let alone, you know, clogging up the computer with useless imagery. It's just more time that you have to spend to get through that material. In terms of quantity as well, I mean, one of the things that I point to is one of the biggest challenges is during Stanley Cup, when those players parade the Stanley Cup around the ice, you used to have 36 frames on a roll of film, and then you had to change. Now I can shoot over 1,000 on a digital card before I have to pull a digital card out. So the thought pattern when you're shooting and you only have 36 frames is, okay, who's the next guy who's going to pick up the Stanley Cup? Do you have enough time to pull a roll of film? And remember then also, first you had to rewind the roll of film, which took a few seconds, then you had to pull the roll out, then you had to put the other roll in and make sure it caught on the sprockets. I mean, it sounds so primitive at this point, but this is what we knew for so many years.
And do you find that helps you nowadays, maybe compared to the quote-unquote younger photographers that might be more trigger-happy and not understand that at some point they're going to have to go through those thousands of photos and find the good ones, whereas you might be a little more discerning and have a higher density of quality pictures?
I think any of the guys who are covering these jobs as a profession, they learn early on, and I mean really early on, okay, let's just settle back and don't be so trigger happy, because that's just going to end up biting you in the butt towards the end of the game or between periods. When you have too many images to look through, the job just becomes that much more staggering.
That makes perfect sense. Let's talk real briefly then about how the nature of the job has changed too, in that when you were first starting to shoot, I mean, there were not as many sources of photography of being able to tell the story of the game through those visuals. And now, I mean, you look up in the stands, everyone has a camera. Everyone's a photographer. You know, it's all over social media. Everyone's taking their own pictures. And do you have to change your mindset to really capture what others cannot capture? Or really, at the end of the day, your access and the quality of your product is always going to trump the thousands of fans that are shooting pictures on their smartphones?
Well, I don't really have too much concern about people with their cell phones or their point-and-shoot cameras, even the guys with the good cameras up in the stands. I'm just concerned with doing the best job I can do, and a lot of that is based on my years of experience and what I know works and what doesn't work. You know, for that matter, really, I don't really concern myself with what other professional photographers are doing either in the building. I'm just concerned with what I can do. And let's all remember that, you know, sometimes someone will look at a photo and, oh, it must have been a great camera that shot that photo. Well, no, it's probably a really good photographer that shot that camera who has a good knowledge of the equipment he's using. So it's not really any kind of concern of mine what anyone else is doing. Sure, there's all the social media stuff out there, but I'd like to think that when someone looks at pictures that are shot by myself or any of the other professional photographers, for the most of the time, they're going to be able to see a difference in the quality.
Okay, well, that certainly makes sense in the greater picture of things. No pun intended. So it really does come down to still maintaining that higher quality that someone taking a photo on their smartphone or even sharing on Instagram with some of those instant filters and instant ability to Photoshop things on your smartphone, on your mobile device. It still comes down to the fact that you are properly trained, you have the best equipment, you have the best access, and even if someone can try to come close, that for someone in your position, it's always going to be the superior product, or I guess at the end of the day, you're just really doing the best that you can, and it's going to trump everyone else.
Oh, I always look at pictures that, you know, some other people have shot, especially the Instagram things, and I go, man, I wish I was that good at Instagram. That's just, you know, I've tried, I've put stuff out on Instagram, and it's just not my thing. I experimented recently with the new Canon 5DS, and it has built-in HDR, which is a process I've always been interested in, and I used it at a couple of hockey games, and I've used it in some outside, some exterior scenes, and I really love the whole process and how the images come out. And I loved experimenting with it, and when I took a couple of photos and I showed them to a friend of mine, the friend responded, "Oh yeah, I do that with my Instagram filters," and it kind of hurt on one point, and another I was like, "Yeah, okay, so maybe that technique is a little outdated, or you know, if most people are going to look at a photo and go, oh yeah, you know, that shot with an Instagram filter, it kind of takes away the hours that I put into." Kind of perfect the technique and get something that I was really proud of. But the industry constantly shifts and constantly changes, and you know, it is what it is. If I put out an image that people like, that's great, and if someone else does it, well, you know, you live with it.
Is that discouraging in any way like you said, you sort of have to stay a couple steps ahead whenever a new app comes out that tries to make this process of filtering and making a photo look better than it really was shot? Is that really you staying ahead of that, or even in a couple of decades, will the ability to discern between what's quality photography with someone that knows what they're doing versus someone that just has an app that automates the process for them, is that going to be a more blurred line?
Well, you know, it's not disappointing to me in any way. There are enough outlets, especially with all the social media that is available to everyone now. There are enough outlets for all of these photos and videos that people are doing, especially the good ones, to rise to the surface and get a lot of eyeballs and get a lot of comments. So, to me, you know, it's a very visual generation. The world is a much more visual place now, and all these forms of social media that get my images out, as well as get individuals' images out from their iPhones and all, I think there's room for all of that. I think it's fabulous.
Definitely, and it'll be interesting to see where the industry starts to evolve over the next handful of years here. But you really provide a perfect segue there to the next one I wanted to explore. And that is really, you start to, for the first time ever now, you really have something of a picture, something of a glimpse into how, quote-unquote, viral a photo may go. And you know, are you paying attention to, wow, this photo I took and it was retweeted a billion times, or it got a ton of great likes on Instagram? Are you starting to pay attention to what people are responding to, or is it really something that you're still about how proud you are of the product as a good piece of photography?
Well, it's always great to get a pat on the back, and that pat on the back could be a like, quite simply. So it's always encouraging when people tell you how much they love your photography, either by a simple comment or the like, on whether that's Instagram or on Facebook or whatever. It's not something really, well, maybe it does sway me to do some different things and to think outside the box a little bit, to come up with something, but I guess I've always done that, is tried to think of something different that people would react to. You know, there are some hockey games I remember many times at Nassau Coliseum. I would sit upstairs and just look around the arena way before people would come in there, and I would think, okay, where else can I put a camera that I have not done before? What would look different? What would be something that would create a stir, would be something that people would talk about, either through social media or through articles that would, you know, basically sell images for Getty Images. So I still continue to do that. I still continue to see other techniques that photographers are doing that can spur me on to something to think about, okay, well, how can I take that technique that someone used in some other genre of photography, and how could I adapt that to hockey and make viable images using a different technique?
So always learning new something new every day. And now everything really is so trackable. I mean, beyond just the Instagram likes and the Twitter retweets and such, even looking at Getty, are you paying attention or even held accountable for how many purchases, how many downloads, how many views that photos with your byline are getting on the Getty website?
If I am, that's kind of being kept behind the scenes. No one's come to find me and say, hey, your hockey pictures aren't selling. So I'm sure that they are. As director of the hockey images for Getty, I look at the sales reports not only for myself but for all our photographers and worldwide, and try to come up with a pattern that says, okay, we need to put more time and effort into a certain kind of photography, whether it's a specific league or it's a specific kind of photography, such as, you know, isolated individual vertical action was something that was huge for many, many years, not so much anymore. You know, the trading cards is only one trading card now, trading card company now, so that's something that we have to consider, and we have to have our photographers adjust the percentage of how much they shoot of interaction versus stock individual isolated action images. So it's constantly taking a look at sales reports, looking at what images sell, and sometimes you can get a pattern out of it that you can decipher, and sometimes you look at images and go, well, I don't know why these images sold, but they sold. Sometimes it's completely perplexing why images are sold. But I do my best to analyze that material so that I can better instruct our photographers on what to provide us with.
Is that sort of analysis a relatively newer evolution for photography in general? I mean, I hate to think that you're out there trying to think, okay, let me make sure I get a picture. This picture is going to go viral on social media, or this picture is going to get a lot of popularity on Getty, versus just trying to tell the story of the game that night, or going through some shots that you had in your mind ahead of time. Are you shooting for the metrics, shooting for social media, or is it not even really in your head at all?
No, I'm not not shooting for you know, with social media in mind. I think, quite honestly, financially, that's a very small part of the picture for any news organizations right now, and that's you know, that's just what really sells well for us, obviously, is the editorial and commercial aspect of the photographs. And going back before I was at Getty Images, there was always a process that would go on analyzing sales and analyzing what clients are looking for and making sure that our photographers followed through on request lists that they are provided with. It's just I'm sure in every photographic endeavor, I mean, that's the way you have to go about things. Where image is selling, and you know, how much is a company making from those sorts of sales? And sure, you want to make every sale. I mean, I always did when I was self-employed, and I do now with Getty Images. I want to sell every hockey picture that anyone would like to have for every single need. And I expect that the photographers that work for us are looking to shoot those kind of images that could sell for every kind of client, whether that's social media uses or websites, editorial or commercial outlets.
How much is really the economics of the position changing? Will photos still be able to sell as a viable, sellable asset, you know, 10, 20 years from now? I mean, hopefully that won't be a concern for you in your career, but will it reach a point where people aren't willing to pay money for a professional photograph because a computer program and, you know, a small little device can do it for them, or at least come close to it?
You know, in some ways, this has gotten dumbed down to any picture and any video is acceptable, and that's fine. I look at, you know, I look at badly shot YouTubes and badly shot images if they have something that I can't find that's shot of something of better quality that was shot by a pro, or something of better quality shot by an amateur. There's a lot of junk out there. So I think for the foreseeable future anyway, there's still a very active market for professional photography.
And I personally love, you know, the great photography I see in like Sports Illustrated, some of the publications out there in your book. Is the print photograph ever going to go away? I mean, is it a different mindset for your industry, knowing that the majority of people that see this photo will be seeing it on a computer or a mobile phone or a tablet?
I don't know if it really matters that much at this point. Look, I'm on the older side of the equation, and I still like holding on to a newspaper, and I like holding on to a book. But I understand having two kids and being around, you know, people in their 30s and you know, and younger and older, and I understand the switch. I understand the ease of looking at everything on an iPad and not physically carrying around a bunch of magazines. But right now, where we are and for the foreseeable future, there's still a market for, you know, for all that, all the media that's out there. And it really doesn't alter how we shoot games. It does alter that the idea when you're at a game, you want to get some images out more quickly, because there are websites that are picking up that stuff immediately. In the old days, you know, you would just have your sales pretty much towards the end of the game when newspapers were on deadline and closing their stories. So, you know, in the transmission of images, it's changed, but we're still, you know, out there shooting for every minute of every game and not really having a large concern about web use versus print use.
Is there any concern about the proprietary nature of the photos? Is piracy, people taking an image and just saving it to their computer or trying to eliminate a watermark, for example, is that becoming a bigger concern for Getty in particular and trying to protect those files that you guys own?
Well, that's always a concern for all the digital media companies that put their images out there. Getty Images came up with a process, I guess it was about a year ago now, called Embed. And with Embed, it allows people to use their images, use the Getty images on their social media sites for free, as long as those sites are non-commercial. So I'd encourage anyone who's looking to use, you know, high-quality images shot by myself and other photographers to go to the Getty Images site and check out Embed. In terms of, you know, copyright violation, well, Getty Images and I'm sure everyone else in this industry is always on guard for that sort of thing. And quite often, besides the cease and desist letters that are sent out and warnings that are sent out, there is a fair amount of cases where those things have to go to trial to protect our intellectual property.
It's certainly very interesting to see some sports teams out there when they tweet out a photo during the game, and some of them will give credit to the Getty or the AP photographer, and some won't. I mean, does it matter to you guys if Bruce Bennett's name is out there as a photographer, or is it, as long as the property is being protected as it should be, is that really your number one concern?
Well, when it's coming from a sports team, we have a relationship with the National Hockey League, and the sports teams can do what they'd like. For me personally, I subscribe to the theory that the name on the front of the jersey is more important than the name on the back. Mm-hmm. So I'm very happy when it just says Getty Images with the photographs. On a personal level, it's great if my name appears with it. There was a photo actually this week that National Hockey League put out on their Instagram, and it was uncredited, and it was my photograph, and I saw it had 31,000 likes, which
wow.
was humongous in my eyes, since I think I got 1,000 followers or something like that. So it had 31,000 likes on the NHL feed, and I wasn't happy that it didn't say Getty Images and it didn't say Bruce Bennett on it. And one of the first comments that I saw was, great job, Bruce Bennett. And I sent a note to the person who put that note in there, and I said, how did you know that was me? And the person responded, oh, well, I saw you at the game, and then I saw the picture on Getty Images, so that's how I knew. So it's a little discouraging, you know, when your name isn't attached to images like that, because I could have probably picked up a few thousand followers on that. But the fact is, as long as the picture is being used in a properly licensed fashion, that works for me.
But even like right now, I'm having a great conversation on the podcast with Bruce Bennett, legendary hockey photographer, director of hockey photography for Getty Images, and author of the new book, Hockey's Greatest Photos, the Bruce Bennett Collection. And even just the fact that you have a book out there with some of your best images, is there more of a need for photographers coming up these days, or more of a desire to build their personal brand so that they can, you know, really monetize themselves and not have to work for a Getty or even just to supplement their own income?
Well, you know, I do look at a lot of portfolios. I do field a lot of questions from young photographers, well, and old photographers, looking to get into the industry. And, of course, it's extremely difficult and extremely limited, especially in these days where freelance photographers aren't permitted into these kind of events.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage all these photographers, you know, to build a website, even a simple, simple, clean, concise. And what you really want to do is put together your best 10 to 20 images at most. And once it's completely ready, then you pass it around to, you know, agencies and newspapers to try to get the word out that you're out there and you're looking for work. It's too often that photographers contact me and other editors who I've spoken with, and a photographer isn't even prepared to show any work. Or the classic is when they ask you if they could come and shoot a game or work for you in a certain city, and when you get down to it, they've never shot a hockey game other than a kid's game. You know, you really need to get your experience, you know, shooting kids, shooting high schools, shooting juniors, and then once you've got enough put into your portfolio, then it's time to start looking to see if you can elevate your game to the pros.
Are some of those up-and-comers, either instead of a website or in addition to a website, are they also linking you to, here, check out my Instagram feed or check out my Twitter feed for all some of my great photos on there?
You know, I don't even mind looking at, you know, a Facebook photos. You know, if it's a clear, concise gallery of these are my 10 hockey photos, it could be a Flickr gallery. It doesn't have to be a website that someone has, you know, put a lot of money in with all the bells and whistles and made it look gorgeous. Just don't email me 10 high-resolution photos and
right.
Clog my inbox and all that stuff. So I don't really care where the gallery is, but it's a little frustrating at times, and it happens a lot. But you know, usually just a gentle note to say, okay, you know, let me know when you have these up online somewhere, and I'll look at them then, and I'll be extremely harsh in my feedback, and that's pretty much the warning I give everyone. I'm not going to tell you you've got an excellent future here if I don't see something that tells me that you've got an excellent future.
Now, are you keeping your eyes open at all on or even people in your position of leadership looking at the NHL or a hockey writer's or even a fan's Twitter feed or Instagram feed and saying, oh, that's a really sweet photo. I wonder who shot that. Let me take a look and see, and see if this guy has some talent or if it's just something that catches your eye.
Well, it's very rare, actually. I know many of the photographers around the country, especially the guys who've been in the industry for a while. Occasionally, someone will recommend another photographer, and I'll go look at their work. It's very rare that I would look at somebody's work, and it hasn't really happened more than, you know, two or three times that I've looked at someone's work and then said, oh, let me get a hold of this guy, or let me investigate this guy a little further. It normally starts from them contacting me to take a look at what they've shot.
Gotcha. So the person that thinks their Instagram feed is getting all these likes and that's going to be their ticket to stardom in the photography world maybe wants to, should try some other things as well.
Well, yeah, but, you know, and the other thing is, you know, on an Instagram feed, well, I think the basic premise of Instagram is the photos are all messed up with. You know, they're not original files. I think the one that I put out today was one of the very few that I didn't mess around with and over sharpen or over saturate or, you know, snap seed it, if that's a verb, or do anything crazy with it. It seems like those images, and I do love a lot of what our photographers do up there and what friends put up there, but we're looking for factual images. In the industry that I'm in, you know, manipulating photos past, you know, past a certain point of losing your editorial integrity is seriously frowned upon. So, you know, an Instagram feed for me probably wouldn't work to for me to judge somebody's talent.
No, that's a great insight, and hashtag unfiltered all the way. Well, Bruce,
right.
I could pick your brain for so long. I'm really enjoying this conversation. We'll have a little more fun with you in our quick-hitting question segment come right up. But first, we have this episode's charitable stat coming right at you. Just a fantastic conversation with Bruce Bennett, director of hockey photography for Getty Images, and also author of the new book, Hockey's Greatest Photos, the Bruce Bennett Collection. Just a legend in his field, and really fascinating to hear from someone with so much experience and so much insight into the way that that digital media, social media, and all these metrics out there is really changing the way the photography works and the way a freelance or a professional photographer makes a living in the sports world. But we'll have a little more fun with Bruce in our Banter with Bruce section coming up. Some quick-hitting questions. Guarantee you want to stick around for that one. But first, we have this episode's shareable stat. This episode's shareable stat is all about where teens in the U.S. are spending time. A recent survey conducted asked U.S. teens, where do you spend the most of your time when it comes to social media? And 64% of the teens, the leading answer was YouTube. So not Facebook, not Twitter, not Snapchat, although those all showed pretty well, with Snapchat capturing 42%. Facebook was number two behind YouTube. But YouTube, 64% of teens consider that the most important place where they spend the majority of their time. That is an incredible stat and really may surprise some sports marketers to think that in order to reach teens these days, they have to be on Snapchat or Yik Yak or Kick or Facebook Messenger. But YouTube is truly a place where you can reach U.S. teens if you're a sports marketer or really anyone. So what does that mean, though? It doesn't mean that you use YouTube as a dump for all your video content, or you just throw some stuff up there just like you would a Vine on the Twitter, or a 9-second Twitter video, you put it on YouTube also. You know, it's not about saturating the market. The people that are winning on YouTube, the so-called YouTubers or influencers out there, are doing so because they're creating consistent stories and a consistent audience that continues to go back to there again and again because they know to expect content and to expect quality content. So what can you do? You know, create some consistent recurring content. Tell a story. Create a little TV show for your team. You know, have a player host a TV show or answer fan questions. Really create that consistent presence that fans can count on. And you'll be having success just like those sort of YouTube influencers are as well. And then that creates a stronger, more engaged fan base, more receptive to your marketing messages, and when you do buy advertising or even insert that into content, it's really a place where you can reach teens that maybe you didn't think about before, but only if you do it right. So go on with a strategy, create content that you know is going to resonate on there and that will really cultivate a community around your YouTube channel and not just a place where you hope that people randomly appear because they're bored or browsing, or you come up in a search or related videos. Yeah, views are great, but it's really great when you have that community. YouTube can still be a place where you conduct social media, and teens want that. So go there. Think about it. So that's this episode's shareable stat. 64% of teens consider YouTube to be one of the most important social media channels for them, where they spend the most of their time. So get your YouTube strategy in place today. Don't make it a video dump. Make it a thoughtful strategy. That's the episode's shareable stat. Spend some time thinking about it. Got it from the ClickZ website, a good resource for some marketing stats, especially in the digital space. But we'll be right back to have a little fun and get to know Bruce Bennett a little bit more, the legendary hockey photographer, as we banter with Bruce. Coming right back at you. All right, that was this episode's shareable stat. Now we're right back with legendary hockey photographer Bruce Bennett, also director of hockey photography for Getty Images, and definitely check out his new book, Hockey Greatest Photos, the Bruce Bennett Collection. But Bruce, you survived your interview. It's now time to have some quick hitting questions for you. Are you ready to banter with Bruce?
I'm not sure. Am I?
Let's do it. Are you ready or not? First question for you. Your favorite hockey arena to shoot photos at, past or present?
Oh, good. I'm so glad you said past. Chicago Stadium was the original Chicago Stadium. Oh, sorry, it's United Center now, but Chicago Stadium, great fans, rabid fans, great atmosphere, steep arena. The fans are just so close to the ice, usually drunk. the horn... just everything about that arena was the best ever, the best.
I get chills just hearing you talk about it. I want to go to that kind of atmosphere and hear Chelsea Dagger play as the Hawks score again. All right, how about this one? If not hockey, what is the other sport that you'd most want to photograph consistently?
Probably Bikini Football League, I would guess. Wow, the other sport I would, let's see, field hockey? No, that doesn't count. That's too close to hockey. I always sucked at volleyball, so it definitely wouldn't be volleyball. Baseball, I fell asleep while I was shooting that. I think I'd have to retire. I think that would be the end of my career. No more hockey, I'm done.
So you're not about to go crouch on the basketball court and risk having 7-foot guys run into you?
You know, I tell you the truth, during this last lockout that we seem to have every few years, I actually started shooting a bunch of basketball games for Getty, and I loved it. It was, you know, you see the players, they're up close, there's no helmets, there's no face shields, there's muscles, there's sweat, there's trash talking. And yeah, except for getting stepped on now and then, I loved it. I really did. The toughest part of that for me was trying to sitting on the floor with your legs crossed, because that was something I think my parents just never taught me how to do. So you sit on like a make-believe lawn chair, miniature lawn chair, and you're looking up at these guys, and I found it really creative and very different and very, for me anyway, I found it very easy to shoot.
So definitely not as cold, too. You don't have to worry about bringing an overcoat into a basketball arena. It's usually hot, if anything.
The only thing is, you know, the ice is usually under those surfaces at Madison Square Garden or at the Barclays Center. They had, they didn't have ice at Barclays back then, but the ice underneath that, you're sitting on the ground and your tush is getting cold from sitting there.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm never going to be able to watch a basketball game at MSG the same way again. I'm going to be thinking about all those cold butts on the floor.
Well, there's a lot of that going on there. It's horrible, horrible.
How about our next question for you, Bruce? Maybe it's the best photo also, but tell me the photo in your career that you're most proud of.
Most proud of? I'm thinking... let's see, give me a minute because there are 2 million images, so I have to start thinking through all of them. How much time do we have? I guess one of them anyway that comes to mind is Mike Bossy with a flaming hockey stick.
Oh, very cool.
That was something we messed around with at home with some cotton dipped in kerosene, stapled to the bottom of a hockey stick, and then actually took it right through the execution. And, you know, wasn't a particularly well-lit image. Technically, it wasn't fabulous, but just being able to do that and not set Bossy on fire, I think, was a big achievement for me.
Yeah, I would think the team would want to make sure you don't light one of the best goal scorers in history on fire.
No.
How about I'm interested in this one. Tell me, what's your preparation like when you go into a major game, or maybe it's preparing for a Stanley Cup Game 7 or a big game between two big opponents? And what's it like when you're planning, here's what I want to shoot, or is it really just, you know, reacting in real time, making sure you're in the best position?
Yeah, well, very different thought pattern game by game versus the Stanley Cup game. Game by game, you know, I'm working all by myself. I try to get into a position, which I can get in many arenas, where I'm in a deep corner position. That means shooting through a hole in the corner of the glass, approximately where the goalie's line intersects the boards. Because from that position, I can see up ice and I can see behind the net. I'm also at ice level because I want to see the player's eyes, which is very important to me. And by being able to see the whole ice, it gives you that sense of security that nothing is out of your grasp if you're fast enough to shoot it and focus on it, or focus first and then shoot, I guess. In a Stanley Cup game or a larger game where we're handling it with a crew, it's a lot more work, because then I'm concerned not only with my position, but the position of my second photographer or third photographer, and coming up with a game plan. That is mapping out not only where the photographers are, but mapping out where remote cameras are, in the rafters or in the net or behind the net, to make sure that no matter what happens on the ice surface, we have the important moment, maybe a cup-winning moment, from every single angle. And hand in hand with that, handling the editors, because on regular games I edit my own material, but on the bigger games, the Stanley Cup games or the outdoor games, we have editors, and how quickly can we get our digital cards or images back from the photographers to the editors, and do they know what kind of material that I need to be put out that night?
Wow,
was that 60 seconds?
That was incredible. That was really good. I appreciate you sharing that. That was awesome. How about let's do a quick follow-up question then on my list. What was it like shooting an outdoor game? I mean, that's something that you haven't done that much over your career, just because it hasn't been, you know, the Winter Classic and the Heritage Classic. So what's it like shooting outdoors compared to being inside an arena?
Well, my years of wisdom taught me that the outdoor game to shoot was the one out in San Jose area last year. I had no intention of going out to Buffalo or Boston or any of those places that are hovering around 5 or 10 degrees. The closest I got was the game in Philadelphia that was, I believe, it was January 2nd a few years ago. And I think it got to a low of 40 degrees, which was actually pretty manageable. For a lot of those games, what I do is I use our local photographers or our photographers who have the gear and the wherewithal to survive in the worst elements possible, temperature, snow, rain. I've never done that my whole career. I don't have the gear to protect my equipment, and I don't really have enough gear or the mentality to protect myself in those situations. Even though I guess as well during the lockout I shot U.S. Hockey Pond Championships out in Wisconsin, and for that I was able to figure out the right combination of what equipment, how to dress, what boots to wear, where to put warmers, how to protect the equipment from the elements. And I was lucky enough that, you know, over the 3 days I was out there, the lowest it got was about 15 degrees. So it was manageable except for my fingertips.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's where you need some gloves or something to still be able to feel your hands so you can click that button to shoot.
And that's the biggest problem is, you know, where do you put warmers? You know, no matter where you put warmers, you still need your thumb and your index finger at the least to be able to shoot. And it just seemed like no matter what I did, you know, my feet were great, but the hands were always a huge issue in terms of keeping them warm and being safe out there.
As someone who went to school in Connecticut and shot a little bit of football in the snow, I can relate to cold fingertips, that's for sure. All right, Bruce, a couple more left for you. How about another quick question for you in 60 seconds or less? Tell me your thoughts on GIFs. Right, how is that really evolving or maybe changing the photography industry that we want our photos to move now?
Well, I think those are, to me anyway, those are kind of outdated. I think we're going to see more video that's introduced in coming years. I think even we're going to have more photographers at some point, not that long down the road, shooting video and having stills coming off their video, or the use of, you know, small snippets like GIFs, 3 second, 2 second, 3 second, 4 second videos, you know, in the marketplace, social media wise, and in websites.
Is Getty preparing for that? Is Getty sort of heading that direction?
I really don't know at this point. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the process is going to be, or what the you know. I'm not sure where we're headed, if we're headed in that direction or not. All I know is I see cameras, I see new generations of cameras coming out. They obviously, all our high-end cameras have video built in. I'm sure it won't be too long time span till 4K video is included in the cameras. I think that's the rumor for upcoming cameras. And, you know, you just look at it and you go, okay, well, you know, I'm happy at some point shooting 10 frames a second and pulling out the definitive moment out of that 10 frame a second burst. Well, if I could shoot 30 frames a second and pull a frame out, then I know I'm going to be even better. My timing is going to be even better, or the image is going to be even better. It's just a matter of whether I can change that video still into a viable digital still. And that's a matter of software and interpolation and your computers being able to handle that and being able to do that in the same sort of time frame that I'm able to send 5 to 10 images between periods of the game. Will I be able to go through video and do the same thing? Or will somebody else be doing that? Will I be transmitting the video and become somebody else's problem trying to edit through and pick the right frames?
Yeah, that's interesting. There's definitely something to watch as time moves on here. All right, last couple one for you. How about your favorite player or subject that you photographed over your career?
Well, I'll give you two. The short answer would be a Swedish player by the name of Thomas Jansson, who used to play for the New York Islanders, simply because he would make the craziest faces when he was playing. His face just, you know, showed the anguish of the game and the pain and the fury. And I mean, it was just nutty what this guy was going through on the ice. But the greater answer is the great one, Wayne Gretzky, because I got so familiar with his movements and things that he would do with the puck, it became a little bit easier for me to track him and anticipate where he was going to move. Of course, he always had a surprise for me, as he had surprises for the defenders he was playing against. But he was someone who I thoroughly enjoyed photographing, you know, throughout all his years that he was playing in the NHL.
I love that. So the great one was also a great photo subject as well. All right, last one before Bruce gets you out of here on. tell us when it comes time to hand off the Stanley Cup and you're in place to shoot a picture of the captain, you know, kissing the cup this coming spring. Who's your pick? Who's gonna take the cup this year?
Well, are you gonna put money on that? I'll tell you, a number of years ago, I decided to go from the first day of the season to the last day of the season and predict the winner of each and every game during the NHL year. And it was probably about 15 years ago at this point. And I write down final scores, and I was really religious about it, keeping that list. And at the end of the season, my percentage was 52% correct. So what I'm saying basically is I don't think you want me to tell you who I would predict, because chances are it's not going to be him, whoever it is.
Do you have a team that you root for that you want to see host the cup?
No, honestly, I don't. I'm a Long Islander. I was brought up on Long Island, and Islanders always treated me really well. They still continue to treat me well. I was their team photographer from '82 until 2004. When I worked for the Rangers as their team photographer, first-class organization, and they treated me well. Devils, Flyers, same thing. So I have a little bit of an affinity to local teams just for the selfish motive that I don't have to go away for 18 or 20 days in a row and be on the, I don't have to pack a suitcase for 18 or 20 days. So having one of those teams in the final is always preferred. But wherever it is, I anticipate being there. And you know, when you get two teams in the Stanley Cup Finals, it doesn't matter who those teams are. You know, you're going to be in for a good time.
Always a special experience. And who knows? You know, maybe if all things go right, maybe John Tavares will be the one lifting the cup this year.
Well, you never know. We'll see.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for your time. First, before we let you go today, tell our listeners, where can we find you on the internet, on web? Where can they pick up your book? Give us the shout out.
Sure. My own website is at brucebennettstudios.com with two N's and two T's. They can look at a portfolio of my work through the years and all the media clips of everywhere I've been through the years. On game nights, you could actually just go to gettyimages.com and you go to the editorial sports tab and you can search by name. It's an open site, so you don't need to have a login or password. And you can take a look at what all our photographers are doing, as well as all the NHL Images photographers, what they're posting on game nights.
And how about
the book.
The book, of course, as well.
Oh, that's right, that book. I forgot about the book. book, I understand, is in bookstores all across Canada, which doesn't help Americans too much. Occasional Barnes & Noble here has it, but it is on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, BarnesandNoble.com, and only at the best bookstores. They'll be carrying the book. I don't like the ones that aren't carrying the book, but the best bookstores will have it.
And how about your Twitter, your Instagram, for fans that want to find you there?
Yep, Bruce_Bennett on Twitter and Instagram.
Oh, perfect. Watch, it's going to explode now with followers.
Oh, my God, we're going to have... Yeah, sounds great.
I highly recommend everyone check out Bruce's work on Getty, on his website, and of course, pick up the book, Hockey's Greatest Photos, the Bruce Bennett Collection, a publication with the Hockey News. Just fantastic stuff, and really a privilege and an honor to have you on the podcast, Bruce. Really appreciate your time, and I know you're getting ready to shoot another game tonight, and that's the life. But we really appreciate you sharing some of your knowledge and some of your insight about what really is a legendary career.
Well, thanks a lot, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much again to Bruce Bennett. Just really an honor and a privilege to be able to have spoken with him, director of hockey photography for Getty Images, legendary hockey photographer, and of course, as we've said, author of the new book, Hockey's Greatest Photos, the Bruce Bennett Collection. Really learned a lot from him, all of his experience, had some great stories, and I wish I could have spent another hour with him. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thank you again for listening. Hope you enjoyed hearing from Bruce. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Get more info on the podcast and other episodes at dsmsports.net. and we'll love to hear from you on Twitter. I'm at NJH287. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time on the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.